Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, director Gurinder Chadha talks murder and masala in her new film, It's a Wonderful Afterlife. Zan Brooks is back in the reviewing seat. We'll be looking at Tina Fey and Steve Carell in Date Night, Greek comedy Dogtooth, and Demi Moore and David Duchovny selling out in The Joneses. And director Todd Solondz revisits old friends in his new comedy, Life During Wartime. I talk to Todd about the art of recycling happiness. Yes, it's the most volcanic film podcast on the web. It's Film Weekly. Director Gurinder Chadha can never be accused of obeying conventions in her storytelling. From Bend It Like Beckham to Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging, she found a way of subverting stereotypes and bringing to the big screen a fresh look at Asian and female characters. It's a Wonderful Afterlife is a film that continues in this vein, a cultural mashup of Bollywood and Ealing comedy with Hammer House of Horror thrown in. It tells the story of an Indian mother who takes her obsession with arranging a marriage for her daughter just that little bit too far.
Murder number one, Indian couple. Wife, it's on the head with a rolling pin. Husband, suffocated with chapati dough.
Shh, none of that, please. None of that.
We've classified this latest incident as murder because forensics have come back with the chili content of the curry, which is way off the human tolerance scale. Everyone, this is Detective Sergeant Murphy. He'll be assisting our team, interviewing members of the local community and the like. Let's get back to basics. Murphy, what do you think's going on here?
Well, I haven't been here long, but murders are rare. Certainly never a serial killer.
We need some good community undercover work here. You're an insider, Murphy. People will talk to you. Whoever's committing these murders knows a thing or two about spices.
But, sir, everyone eats curry now. Chicken tikka masala is the number one national dish, so everyone's a potential suspect.
Exactly.
Gurinder Chadha, congratulations on It's a Wonderful Afterlife.
Thank you, Jason.
It's not a bad this life as well.
No. This life is very good. Yes, one must appreciate it, yes.
Exactly. Where did you get the idea for this? Because it seems extremely personal as a project to you, and yet, of course, it's completely fantastical and imagined. So when did you cement the idea that you'd have these ghosts following a poor Indian mother around?
Well, the actual germ of the idea came from me watching one of these top 100 movie shows.
Was I in that?
You probably were. It was the one with family films.
Oh yeah, I was in that.
And there was a clip of Bend It Like Beckham in, and it was the clip of the Indian wedding, and I was sitting there watching it, you know, thinking, oh, I love shooting that scene, it was so much fun, I'm never going to be able to shoot another Indian wedding scene again unless I subvert it. And then I had this brilliant idea of shooting a big Indian wedding in a marquee, but turning it into the prom scene from Carrie. Mm. And I just thought, you know what? That is a scene that I would love to see in a movie. And unless I make that movie, it's never going to happen.
This is true.
And that's really what happened. I just thought, you know, I want to make a schlocky comedy horror film set in the Asian community. And it's very rare that, you know, people like me get to do that, because we always have to make sort of issue-based, don't we? We're always sort of thinking, oh, we better plug this, or we better, you know, positive stereotype here and all this number. And I just thought with this, I thought, nah, I want to do schlock. I want to make it funny.
The specificity of it is what really appealed to me. That you mentioned Stanmore, Wilsdon, you mentioned Ealing and Hayes, you mentioned B&Q, you mentioned Gerrard's Cross. It's that that actually anchors it in the reality. The fact that you don't kind of pander to, say, American tastes and kind of just say, well, North London or West London. You keep it very, very real.
Yeah, I think the more specific you are culturally, the more universal you become. And I think audiences around the world recognize when you're being specific, even if they don't know the references, you know, themselves. But they understand, you know, that that is a specific reference, you know. And they just relate it to their own sort of specific areas, I think.
And I think that the same with the food. You don't kind of, you know, you don't kind of lessen the food impact. You know, they're skewered by chicken tikka kebabs. They are, you know, murdered by the hottest curry possible. And what is that? Is it a chapati?
Naan. There's naan flour on his mouth. Yeah. He's been suffocated by chapati dough. Yeah.
I mean, some people might take great offence at this, were it not for your kind of, you know, the breezy way in which you handle this on film. Are you aware of that? Is that something you know you can get away with? You kind of have a cheeky style that kind of no one could really take offence at, or if they did, one would want to strangle them with the chapati dough.
I think one of the hardest things about making this movie was getting the tone right. Because tonally, you know, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Because we go from scary sort of ghosts to very schlocky stomachs exploding to, you know, beautiful sort of romantic moments to crying. I mean, it's all over the, you know, it's everything is in here. But I was out of my comfort zone for sure when I was shooting. And when I saw the first assembly, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Mm. But I think it was really good to be out of my comfort zone because it just really made me focus down more on what I wanted to do here, actually. And rather than peddle a line like I normally feel, you know, that I can do quite easily, especially being a journalist, you know, that journalism has, you know, definitely part of me as a director.
Always pursuing the story.
Yeah, absolutely. With this, I let it flow a bit more. I just let it happen more. And so we end up with quite a spiritual ending, which I didn't intend, but it's become that because if you're going to make a film about death, you know, somewhere it's got to be spiritual.
Yeah. There's sometimes I see your films and I think, I wonder when she's going to pare it down again. You've gone so colourful and so kind of, as you say, I don't know, almost creating your own genre of stuff. But I do think back to Bargee on the Beach, which had a kind of roots in social realism, if you like, that kind of almost Ken Loachian kind of feel. I wonder if you'll ever go back to that kind of filmmaking, or if you're now always stuck with a, not stuck in the best kind of way, with a big wedding scene and a big musical number.
Well, when I first came onto the scene, my purpose was to take people like me out of the margins and make us mainstream. That was what I intended to do. And when I first started, if there was ever an Indian person on television, everyone would go, quick, there's an Indian on TV, quick. And now, I mean, this last year, you know, Christmas Day, EastEnders, big Indian storyline. You've had The Family, you know, the reality show. Every soap, you know, has got Indian characters. Every, you know, hospital drama, everything. And in a way, you know, I mean, I think my work has sort of helped contributed to making the Asian family sort of very much part of mainstream British media life. I feel now that I need to sort of spread my wings a little bit and push myself into other areas.
Does this mean making a film that isn't about the Indian community?
I think this is about not making a comedy. And the two films that I'm working on at the moment, and whether it will be one of these films, I'm not sure, but I've decided to spend most of this year writing. We are writing a wonderful children's film set in Kerala with elephants, and very innocent, like children's films used to be, you know, sort of nice adventure and very good sort of story.
No smart talking Brooklyn squirrels.
No, exactly, exactly. And the other project I'm working on is a film based on the book Freedom at Midnight, which is about India's independence, but told from the perspective of a British Asian woman. Again, that's me going back into my history, and, you know, history is made by the tellers. And so this is my opportunity to go back and relook at how partition happened, basically, and how, you know, my sort of family line, you know, how it was sort of divided, and my homeland, which of course is now Pakistan, is sort of no longer my homeland, or is it, you know?
Lovely to see you, Gurinder, as ever, and congratulations on It's a Wonderful Afterlife, which, you know, as ever, is as breezily enjoyable and infectious as all your other stuff.
Thank you, and it opens April 21st.
Oh, yeah. Well, as the one-woman film industry herself puts it, It's a Wonderful Afterlife opens here in the UK from April the 21st. Maybe too spicy for some, but I liked it. Now, joining me to review some of this week's other releases is Zan Brooks, freshly returned from an odyssey in France. Zan, how did you get here? Did you beat the volcanic ash?
No, the volcanic ash beat me, but in the end I effected an escape by driving my rental car basically across the whole country.
Of France?
With a five-year-old child in tow.
Just you and your little
daughter? Yeah, yeah. It was lovely. It was like that book by Cormac McCarthy, The Road, except a kind of middle-class version of it,
where
it was just
L'autoroute.
It was just me, rental car, and credit card.
Zan, perhaps we should turn our attention to this week's film. We'll be looking at families, which I suppose is apt, given your odyssey across France mm-hmm. with your daughter. We'll be looking at Steve Carell and Tina Fey on a date that goes wrong in Date Night. The Joneses, starring Demi Moore and David Duchovny in a sales pitch that gets out of hand, and another high-concept family comedy from Greece, Dogtooth. But let's start with Date Night, which stars Tina Fey of 30 Rock and Steve Carell of The Office, attempting to bring some of that TV success to the big screen. They play a boring couple from New Jersey who leave the kids behind every Thursday and go in search of romance. One such date night leads them to a cool Manhattan restaurant where they steal somebody else's reservation, with consequences that lead them into a comic nightmare involving the mob.
Excuse me, Mr. and Mrs. Triplehorn.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well.
Hello, yes. We are the Triplehorn. Horns.
Oh, boy.
Who, might I ask, are you to be asking us who we are?
We just wanted to have a few words with you, if that's okay.
And what is this about?
I think you know.
Why don't we save everyone a lot of embarrassment and have this conversation in private?
Okay, but can I have the rest of my risotto wrapped? Because these truffles are amazing and super expensive.
Get up. Now.
Honey,
get up.
Now.
Zan, Tina Fey, Steve Carell, are you fans of theirs to start with? Because I guess that's where this is aiming. If you like them, you probably go and see this movie. It's one of those kind of Hollywood films.
It is. I mean, that's almost the sole purpose of making this film, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
Tina
so.
Fey's stock is very much on the up. Since the sort of the Sarah Palin revelation.
It's basically, isn't it? That's why we know her in this
country. Absolutely. Yeah. Even if you don't know her from 30 Rock, you know her from the Sarah Palin impersonation.
I kind of liked her film Baby Mama, which I thought was rather funny. And she did write Mean Girls, which is probably one of the best, well, certainly the best Lindsay Lohan movie.
Yeah.
Not a very high pile one, which to be top of. But it's one of the better high school movies as well, actually. I really liked it. So she's a very gifted writer and comedian.
Can she
become a movie star? Can she act well enough to be at the star of a big comedy?
I think that she can, and Steve Carell has obviously proved that he can before, and they're both very likeable presences. I'm not sure that this is quite the right vehicle for them. It's a screwball caper, but screwball capers are the weird thing, that they're probably the most era-specific genre that there is, and they don't actually translate to the modern world. I don't know what goes wrong in the mix. It's like people see these sort of great William Powell, Myrna Loy films from the 30s and 40s and think, we'll do that now, but we'll just amp it up. We'll just make it a bit noisier, a bit more slapstick, a bit more violence in there. And the lightness is sort of gone.
No, I also have a problem with the fact that they go to Manhattan and they kind of get involved in this kind of mob, corrupt cop thing. But Manhattan is the shopping mall of the world now. There's no danger in Manhattan anymore. It reminded me, there was an old film, Sandy Dennis film with called The Out-of-Towners, which I think was remade awfully by Steve Martin recently. And the thing is that there isn't, it's not dangerous in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's not Taxi Driver land anymore,
no,
is it?
No, you're not going to get caught up with corrupt cops in Manhattan.
You're not. And it gets the details right at the very swank restaurant where they can't actually get a seat. But then the next thing you know, they're running through Central Park with gunmen after them.
It does sort of have one of those, I suppose, what we call zeitgeisty kind of pegs, where people are now going to talk about date nights. We don't have them as such here, but I've heard more people sort of say, oh, I have a date night with my wife, you know, when you have to arrange the kind of babysitter to come in on Tuesday, otherwise you just don't go out anymore.
Yeah, I guess so.
And it just about pegs that. It just about gets that right. And they do a little book club as well, and that's quite a funny
scene. Is that zeitgeisty, or has that always been the case?
Well, I don't know. No one's ever made a film about it before.
And I suppose not. But
I've heard people sort of saying, I went to see this film and someone said, oh, I'm with my husband and it's our date night tonight.
Oh, right. So on your date night, you go and see Date Night. That's like staring into the mirror,
isn't it? It did remind me of a Seinfeld episode, because it's one of those kind of comedies where they steal someone's reservation and then these things happen. And a lot of people sort of say, oh, you stole somebody's reservation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has that Seinfeld-y bit. Probably not enough of it.
Not enough.
Too high tool.
Yeah, Seinfeld would have made much more of the absurdity of that and the slight New York etiquette. This has that in it keeps kind of creeping in. But then there's another car crash, so it's fine.
They've got to get people watching it for that, those reasons. It's Tina Fey and Steve Carell in Date Night. You say it's a high concept comedy. Well, let's move to another high concept comedy about another family, The Joneses, which stars Demi Moore and David Duchovny with their beautiful teenage kids. They're the envy of the new neighbourhood into which they move. However, they turn out to be not the perfect family after all. Instead, they're an elaborate con planted by a shady corporation designed to bring out the avaricious consumer in all of us, copying to keep up with those Joneses.
I mean, you're still selling to individuals, and what you want to create is a ripple effect where you get other people to be selling for you.
Is there anything that you like to do to relax, like go shopping or maybe
you know, there's always people who others look to for advice or the inside scoop, and then they become the connectors that reach the consumer on your behalf. Do you know what I mean? What?
I just thought we'd have a normal conversation like normal people today.
I don't know if you understand the pressure. I mean, you know, this isn't about me selling my products. I have to ensure that my unit is selling their products.
Do you have a unit? That explains why we're in separate bedrooms, perhaps.
Demi Moore and David Duchovny. I've always thought David Duchovny, talk about Tina Fey and Steve Carell being sort of small screen stars. I always thought that Duchovny works really well in the small screen. I liked him in The X-Files and when it was on the small screen. And in Californication, I think he's rather good. He's got this kind of such a laid-back actor that he doesn't really have a big screen persona. Does it work here?
He's a strange mixture as a performer. He's obviously very suave and charming, but there's a slightly kind of off-kilter sort of unease.
There's a weaselliness.
Yeah, there is. There's a sort of ferret quality to him that maybe when you see that on the big screen doesn't look quite so enticing.
Yeah, however, that kind of works very well here because he plays a sort of failed, whatever he is, failed golf pro and car salesman, and finally sort of coming into his own, really, as this kind of, well, con man.
Yeah, it's sort of Death of a Salesman updated, isn't it, in a way, this film. I mean, you know, this is the real zeitgeisty film. This is the postmodern parable of the black ops marketing tool that's posing as the idyllic American family. Because of that, this is a film that touches on a lot of things. It's a fascinating film beneath its sort of gloss, sometimes almost in spite of itself.
Initially, I thought, well, this is one of those property porn films. It's kind of really interesting to watch. But actually, is it a bit sort of outmoded because everyone's kind of hard up from the recession? And then you get the neighbour, played by Gary Cole, another one of those Weasley characters, I think excellent in this film, who tries to keep up with the Joneses with tragic consequences. And that really is where the film kind of actually becomes something rather better.
Something rather better. And there's also the nice meld of there are obvious phony sort of spoof product placements in there. There's this sort of the Alcopop jukebox and things like that that's obviously marketed at kids. But then there is real product placement in this. And you think, how do they thrash out that kind of deal? And what are the implications of that deal? Is this basically the filmmaker, writer-director Derek Bork, using the brands and subverting them by putting them in this film? Or are they then subverting him back and still getting their message across?
It's interesting, isn't it?
It's one of those things that's very hard to tease out.
A couple of times I was thinking, oh, that Lacoste t-shirt looks kind of hot.
Looks good, yeah.
Exactly. But, as you say, the subversion, and I think that does come back to bite the film slightly on the
bum. It does a bit, it does.
Because the ending is not as strong as the rest
Absolutely.
Of it. And that's probably because it's a Hollywood product run by a big corporation and then has to sell stickers, and people, test audiences probably went, well, I would like a sort of happier ending and not such a dark ending. Whereas actually what we really wanted was the darkest.
You do. And it's set up to be basically a pitch black comedy. And then it begins to complicate that. And at first I was happy with the way it was complicating it, because basically, you know, you've got the thing where the salesmen are as much victims of this culture as the people that they're duping. But then you've got the thing of, if you're playing the role of the family, then you start living that role. And then it gets tricky. And that is interesting. But at the same time, then it goes into sort of slightly mushy soap opera territory.
Exactly. It's when reality interferes and David Codney sort of has a bit of a crush on Demi Moore, who, you know, I haven't seen for ages, Demi Moore, other than sort of Charlie's Angels. Something like that.
Yeah, who's very good in this.
Nice actress.
And some good lines in there with the teenage son is having problems, and Duchovny says to him, "Why don't you know, you can always talk to your fake mother."
Yeah, exactly. No, it was really good. And then there's another bit where he says, "I was heard. How are the other 12 husbands?" and I like Lauren Hutton as the kind of rather kind of
spooky, the corporate head.
Yeah, good choice as well, because of course she was in American Gigolo, but also she's the face of one of those big cosmetics corporations as well, or used to be.
Yeah,
that's The Joneses. Which would you see if you had to choose between your two big concept Hollywood comedies this week about families, would you choose Date Night or The Joneses?
Oh, easily The Joneses. Easily.
Right. Well, let's move into another high concept family comedy, this time from Greece. It's called Dogcooth and it's directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. It won the Uncertain Regard section in Cannes last year. It's about a father and mother who keep their children at bay by sealing them in hermetic compound, paying for them for sex, inventing words for them and a whole new language, and also keeping them in terror of domestic animals.
Στο σπίτι ή στον κήπο.
Then the truth about dog tooths and cats who seem to kind of keep these children from straying into the real world. This is a strange old film.
This is, isn't it? And there's a weird parallel between all of these films this week. They're all middle class family nightmares in a way, even though the range of the palette is very different. And this is certainly the darkest of the lot.
Right, let's go into that compound. Take me there.
Well, this is you know a parable, I guess, of people who live in gated communities and the terror of the outside world. The children here who aren't children at all. They're all kind of adults, but they're kept away from the outside world. They have their own lexicon of bogus definitions of things, like a zombie is a yellow flower.
And what's a salt cellar? Something ridiculous.
Yeah,
like
and
a
the sea is
a,
yes, and the sea is a chair. And when they see a plane go overhead, they're told that it's actually just a toy. And so they're living in this splendid isolation. But within that, of course, cracks appear and it all begins to sort of break down. And it breaks down with the outside world creeping in, but it also there's a sense that it's breaking down from within anyway, that you can't keep people completely hermetically sealed.
Yeah, what's it all about, this film?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? It's making very bold gestures, and it's setting itself up as an important film about this strain of the world that these characters live in. You know, it's a film for the Joseph Fritzl age. It has a little bit of kind of Ulrich Seidel in there, yeah. A bit of Michael Haneke,
definitely,
maybe.
Because everyone wears white and they're a bit creepy. You know?
Yeah. I'm not sure it's much more than a great idea or a great thesis. I'm not sure that I particularly cared about any of these
characters. Is it a comedy? Did you laugh?
No, I didn't laugh at all.
No.
I mean, I'm
fine with comedies in which you don't laugh, where you kind of go... Hmm.
That makes you uneasy. That's fine. I think you have to sort of care about the characters a bit, and I didn't really.
Many
with
people
this.
Who I respect
people love
really
it.
Like this yeah. film. I'm afraid it didn't work its magic on me.
And no, I thought
you might like it. I thought we might fight dog tooth and nail over
it. No, I admired it. I admired the way it had an integrity to it. It was beautifully made. It's shot in these sort of stark formal compositions. It's slow burning, which makes it sound like there's some heat there at all, and it's not as chilly as anything. But the chilliness actually did keep me a bit of an arm's length from it, really.
Yeah, I found that as well. I thought it was so hermetically sealed, I couldn't come in. You wouldn't let me into these characters, and I didn't really care about these
Which is
kids.
Sometimes, you know, I have to say it's sometimes a problem I do have with Michael Haneke's films too. But I think that Haneke at least gives you something a bit more meaty.
Yeah, whereas I felt like the meta is always strong in Michael Haneke. You always feel like he's such a god that you can kind of come outside and kind of go, and
yes.
You observe. Whereas this one, I don't think that the filmmaker had quite the skill that you need to kind of take a back step and kind of go, well, this is a political allegory or a fable about consumer society. Do you remember that film, La Zona?
Yes, it was a bit like that, yeah.
Which is set in Mexico City. A bit like that, but a bit, I didn't...
A film that I liked very much from last year, Tony Manero, which had that sort of existential kind of frisson and the chilliness and the clamminess to it too.
Yeah, but that had dancing in
but
it.
But it had
disco.
Dancing in it, and it was funny. It had a kind of proper
that
vein
was black,
of black humour.
Blackly comedy.
Whereas this is just a little bit too intellectual and distant.
Yeah, that's Yorgos Lanthimos' Dogtooth, which Zanna, I didn't like as much.
Not as much
as
I wanted to.
I wouldn't get the circle.
But then
regard.
I want to like them all, Jason.
We always want to like them all. You know, we're talking about dark comedies and stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to talk to Todd Solondz in a minute, because Life During Wartime, now there's a dark family
that's
comedy.
That's a great
as well.
Film, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm glad we think that it's a great film, because we're not going to review it, because I'm going to talk to Todd about
talk
it.
Talk to Todd.
But we both like it. We know that you saw it in Venice, and I've now caught up with it, and it's terrific. So, Zan, thank you for that. I shall send your regards to Todd Solondz. that will give him happiness, if nothing else.
Yeah,
I'm
there's
sure.
not much that gives him happiness. No, but maybe that will.
That, if anything, will. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. Well done for making it back to be with us through France. I look forward to the screenplay of you and your daughter's journey in the
There's
car.
A role in there for you, Jess.
Thank you very much. Well, am I the sort of shady customs officer who you bribe to let you onto
you
the Eurostar?
You can be the hotel cleaner.
Ah, bonjour. Thank you very much. Zan Brooks will be writing on The Guardian's website, www.guardian.co.uk/film. Cast your minds back to the last century, if you will, and you'll remember a time when you were asked to bring back something from the video store, circa 1999. You picked up the surefire crowd pleaser called Happiness, an indie sensation written all over the cover. It's got that funny Philip Seymour Hoffman guy on the cover. You brought it home, you press play, and you subjected your friends and loved ones to the most dark and disturbing black comedy ever made. It was not for the faint-hearted. It was directed by Todd Solondz. Well, a decade or so later, his newest film, Life During Wartime, revisits some of those characters from Happiness. And, surprise, surprise, they're still not very happy.
Do you think we could have another go at it? Like on a trial basis?
But, Andy, I'm married.
That's okay. No one has to know. It would be our secret, just you and me.
I have so many problems, Andy. My husband and I don't know what to do. Oh, and I feel so betrayed.
Sometimes cheating can help a marriage.
No, no, don't say that. Cheating is wrong. Unfair. It's hurtful.
One man for the rest of your life. It's not natural.
Oh, but I'm trying to improve things.
Tell me, Joy, please. After all that's passed, knowing all you know now, do you wish she could have been with me before?
No.
That's Joy and Andy there, played this time by British actress Shirley Henderson and Pee Wee Herman, Paul Rubens. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on the line from New York by Todd Solondz. Now, we've just heard a clip of Joy and Andy there. And of course, it brings to mind that wonderful, wonderful moment where Andy is dumped by Joy in Happiness. And then he says to her, I'm champagne and you're a shit. And it's kind of one of the great kind of, you know, breakup lines of all time. I just wonder what it was that led to you wanting to resurrect these characters from Happiness.
Well, really, after I had finished Happiness, I never imagined I would ever revisit these characters or stories. I guess I wasn't imaginative enough at the time, because about 10 years later, I found myself just writing the first scene of this movie, and I stopped and questioned, is there still more material to mine here? And I felt there, in fact, was.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I people are always doing sequels. I mean, it's kind of an odd franchise, Todd, if I'm honest, but it's a franchise, you know, take it where you can get it.
Well, I would love it if it were a franchise in the profitable sense. I think what the audience has to keep in mind is that this is not a repetition, but of that experience that they had in Happiness, but I think it has a different tone or quality to it.
It certainly does, Todd. You famously said Happiness in New Jersey, which you dubbed, of course, a state of irony, and now you've moved the action mainly to Florida, which is, of course, the Sunshine State. But those words seem to me replete with irony.
Well, Florida has certain resonance. It's a place, certainly for this film, where lives can be reinvented, where the past can be erased. Certainly, that's why Trish moves there, to as if she can eradicate the past, but in fact those phantoms, ghosts, are there to haunt and remain there.
Exactly. It's and Shirley Henderson's character Joy comes down to Florida from New Jersey to kind of escape, but the ghosts follow her more than any character, I suppose, in real terms. I just wondered where you found Shirley Henderson from. She's one of my favourite actresses, a great British actress, but you know, she lives up in Scotland, she's kind of quiet, she doesn't have the roles perhaps that her great talent desires, but I was delighted to see her working so beautifully with you. Where did you spot her? What made you cast her?
Well, I first fell in love with Shirley when I saw her with this mustache in Intermission.
Yes.
About, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And I was very intrigued and curious about her. And I had a stopover in London several years ago, and she came and she read for me. And I fell in love with her, and she's just genius. I mean, because she is she's so prepared and so grounded emotionally in the reality that the character requires.
Yes, it struck me watching her because she's so gifted at playing different forms of comedy. She's done it for Mike Lee, and as you say, she can be a knockabout stuff. You know, you've got Alison Janney now, and Ally Sheedy, and Charlotte Rampling, and Michael Lerner. All of these actors who've worked for in many different genres, they come into a Todd Solondz film. Is there a certain rhythm that they pick up on, or that is there inherent in your script, or are you an improviser? Do you allow them to bring their own skills to the table in that respect? How much of it is planned? How much of it is the Todd Solondz world they know they're buying into?
I don't know. I have a very conventional approach. I mean, I read actors and the ones that seem most appropriate are the ones that I cast. There are some that I might just offer the part to without reading them because it's not necessary, but by and large people read for me. And I make a leap of faith as much as they do in me.
Yes. It's interesting you mentioned faith because Michael Lerner, who's great to see in your film, but obviously when he comes, he brings a sort of iconography of having been in the Coen brothers films. And I notice he pops up as Solomon Schlutz, the lawyer, very briefly in the Coen brothers' recent A Serious Man, which is another film which has a bar mitzvah in. Your film has a bar mitzvah in, which is, you know, it's becoming a genre now, the bar mitzvah movie. And I'm delighted to say that you have a good one, but they both seem to be films that are exploring moral behavior in the modern time. I think that theirs had the Vietnam War kind of coming up in a whirlwind at the end. Yours is, you know, life during wartime, mentions Bush and McCain very much. So is there a sort of is there something in the climate at the moment, especially maybe in the Jewish climate in particular, that is studying the moral behavior, how to be a mensch, to use a word that is mentioned in both of those movies?
I think there's always I hope at least a moral center, a moral anchoring to what I do without being moralistic or moralizing. So I suppose coincidental. I love the Coens movie. Mm. As far as Michael Lerner goes, you know, when you mentioned baggage, I think the you always want to find something fresh for someone. And I don't know that many people considered Michael Lerner for a romantic lead, and so that was very appealing for me.
Absolutely, no, it was extremely refreshing. But the moral issue, I think, is important because I think people certainly criticized Happiness because of obviously you have a strand of a pedophile being quite a major character in there, and of course you resurrect Dylan Baker's character from Happiness, comes back now as Kieran Hines' character, reformed in some way, let out of jail in some way. Revisiting that subject in the first place was controversial enough. Revisiting that subject, Todd, must have been both fraught with interest from your point of view, but also some kind of danger.
Well, I think one of the things that was a little bit troubling or that I wanted clarified was that the Bill Maplewood character that Dylan Baker and now Kieran Hines play, I never found to be sympathetic. I found him to be a tragic figure, but not a sympathetic one. I think I was a little bit more rigorous in my view and was a little troubled to hear that people felt sympathy for a character for whom I could not feel sympathy, as I would not feel sympathy for someone who had committed his crimes. But the fact that there is a human pulse that underlies the monstrousness of his deeds is what is so challenging and compelling. And the material itself, of course, is out in the press and in the tabloids and the TV every day. The subject matter itself is not novel or fresh, but it's a question of the way in which one examines it.
It's interesting you say that it's everywhere in the TV and the news, but actually it's not that prevalent in filmmaking for some reason. Like Kevin Bacon tried it in a film called The Woodsman a few years ago. People, for some reason, on the cinema have difficulty creating these characters. Is it because the nature of drama, the nature of cinema, is that one has to identify with a character? And as you say, like maybe they did for Dylan Baker, that sympathies get misconstrued, that you don't really want to identify with these characters, and yet you have to make the drama work.
No one wants to. No, that's the most unmarketable concept. And who can blame people for not wanting to? But that's why my movies, as sad or sorrowful as in this case I think as mournful as they may be, always remain comedies. It's the comedy and the pathos is always inextricably and intertwined, and this is what makes I think the films have a certain charge, a certain. Perhaps this is from whence the controversy arises. If this is a comedy, how can one? If this is serious, how can one laugh? Or how can you treat any of this in any way, in any way where irony is at play? But it's the irony that makes it all bearable. I don't think I could watch it without it being a comedy.
Yes, we talked about it being a franchise before. You could call it Irony Man 2.
Well, I'll let you do that. You're the creative one with the marketing more than me, I think.
Go on, I got a laugh there, Dan, a little laugh. It reminds me of the wonderful line in Happiness, of Course, where she says, well, we're not laughing at you, we're laughing with you. And then Joy says, well, I'm not laughing. Are you working on a new project?
Well, I have the script. I'm just working on the money. You see, again, it's just these are very grim times. I think because of the internet and the TV with 1,000 channels, it's very difficult to attract an audience to movies like mine. I don't have 3D glasses, and so it's very hard for my kind of movie to be profitable. We'll see, how things evolve. I wish I could be more optimistic, but it does seem there's been something of a shift in the world at large, the viewing habits. When I write for that big dark room with a big screen. But most people, certainly young people, I think these days, by and large, see most of their movies just downloading them from the computer.
I think that brings in an interesting thing, because here in the UK, I don't know how it was in the US, but here in the UK, your film is being released in the cinemas, the big dark rooms, thankfully. But it's also being released, I think, simultaneously on Sky Movies and Download to Own, and I think and followed very swiftly upon by DVD as well. It's becoming an experimental model. Your film, which seems an odd film on which to do that with, but I suppose you can maximise the smaller audience that it will have.
Well, I can't really talk to the economics of it, but people are being as inventive and resourceful as they can, given the circumstances. I always feel that, nevertheless, that if my film is being pirated, it must mean that I have succeeded. I think it's only those movies that are not pirated that one must feel something of less than a successful effort.
Todd, do remain optimistic. Please get another project made. I know that an optimistic Todd Solondz is slightly oxymoronic, but it's what we want, really.
No, look, every time you make a movie, it's a great gesture of optimism. So I think the everything in its context. I'm bleak, but only in the most hopeful sense.
Huge thanks to Todd Solondz, and Life During Wartime is on UK release from Friday the 23rd of April, and as you heard, on Sky Movies simultaneously. That is all for this week. The music featured on this week's show is called Genus. It's by British techno composer Joby Talbot and Deru. It was commissioned by the Paris Opera Ballet for a piece called Genus by British choreographer Wayne McGregor, and he and the extraordinary dancers of that company are the subject of a brilliant new documentary out this week. It's called La Danse, and it's filmed by the brilliant American documentary maker Fred Wiseman, a living legend. He is also the subject of my latest In the Director's Chair, which you can see the whole series of if you go to the Guardian's film website. You can also read me in this Sunday's Observer, of course, where Trailer Trash contains an interview with Yorgos Lanthimos, director of Dogtooth, and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, we'll see you next week with that brilliant British actor, Ian Hart. Goodbye.